Duran. That's the kicking music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week on the show, last week it was spring break. This week it's almost tax time. So we're going to talk about the pop culture portrayals of the extremely rich. Then we're going to do a segment that we're calling Made for Me about things that we feel are especially formulated in a laboratory to appeal just to us. And as always, we'll finish the show with what is making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies for the NPR website, and can I just say I'm really glad that we're kicky again?
You can. You can say that. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Very, very happy to see everybody. Well, it is that time of year. It is tax time. So in the great spirit of the fact that tax time always makes us feel extremely wealthy, we thought we would talk about the very, very rich in pop culture. So what first came to my own mind was Trading Places.
Sure.
Because in Trading Places you have, you know, they're evil, but, you know, they don't start out to be irredeemably evil. They just gradually turn out to be evil. The two brothers, Mortimer and Randolph Duke, played by Don Ameche and Ralph Bellamy, who come up with this incredibly awful scheme to take Dan Aykroyd, their well-heeled young employee, and have him, as many of you know, trade places, as the title says, with Eddie Murphy's sort of con man. And they're doing this on a bet to figure out whether it's nature or nurture, because one of them believes that this will lead these guys to actually, have each other's fates. And the other one believes that, the way you're born will always win out. And of course, as always has to happen in a movie like this, ultimately the rich guys are vanquished and everybody else gets together. And, you know, if you have not seen it in a while, I do recommend it. It is quite funny. But one thing that strikes me about the portrayal of the rich in this movie is that they become both an obstacle to be overcome and, of course, something to sort of aspire to, because there's also a let's take all their money and keep it for ourselves, which doesn't really make them nasty for being rich. It makes them nasty for being nasty, but that it's fine to be rich.
Well, and that there's a difference between being rich and being greedy.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think that's exactly right. They wind up on the hot seat not merely because they keep everything for themselves, but because they are playing with other people.
Yeah, they're playing God.
Right. Glenn, how about you? Rich people in pop culture, any thoughts?
Well, I was thinking about this for the discussion today, that there are two filmmakers who deal with the very wealthy in two kind of related ways. I'm thinking about Whit Stillman and Wes Anderson. These two guys share a lot of filmic DNA, and their topics kind of overlap a lot. The thing that struck me, though, is that I love every single Wes Anderson film I've ever seen, even Darjeeling Limited. Yes, even Darjeeling Limited.
Oh, I know many people who like that movie.
I love these movies. I find Whit Stillman's films repellent.
Now you're talking about Last Days of Disco.
I'm talking about Last Days of Disco, Metropolitan, and Barcelona. He's got a new one out called Damsels in Distress, which is already in theaters.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
With Wes Anderson films, there is an essential sadness to these characters. They can be jerks, but he is showing them to us to kind of fillet them, open them up, and expose their flaws. I get this weird sensibility from Whit Stillman films that he really admires these entitled, protected jerks. And that is a very different feeling. Even though, ostensibly, they're very similar, there's just something wrong about that.
Even though, I mean, you could interpret it as sort of affection for all of humanity. I mean, as a generosity toward human beings.
Yeah,
I say that as somebody who is, I am a huge Wes Anderson guy, and Rushmore and Royal Tenenbaums were two of the films that I had come here armed with to talk about. But, and I have not seen, I'm not sure I've seen any of Stillman's films.
So, you don't need to. No, you should check it out.
Come now.
You should check it out. Whit Stillman, I don't know what those films are about except this life, this sort of disaffected, disconnected lifestyle.
Yeah.
Whereas with Wes Anderson, they are about something. He reminds me a great deal of Cheever. Cheever gets dinged for being about, cocktail parties. But he gets dinged like that by people who haven't really read him.
Yeah.
They've read about him, they haven't read him. Because there's a weird, very human sadness and sexuality often underneath the surface of those stories. And that's where I really feel that Wes Anderson is really working in that territory. Hannah and Her Sisters, a beloved film. The first time I saw that film, I still thought, I don't like these people. Look, mm-hmm. look at their little protected, little perfect little life mm-hmm. here in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a lot of it has to do with me, is what I'm saying.
I think I'm hearing that. I'm hearing that come through. Whit Stillman, for what it's worth, has been giving a round of interviews connected with damsels in distress, and at least in the one that I read, the one that I edited for NPR, he talks at some length about the absurdity of his characters and their situation. So I think he's not unaware of how silly these things are and what a strange little milieu he's working.
It's a very fraught prospect to try to get people to sympathize with the very, very rich. You can do it in a couple ways. Wes Anderson does it with empathy, with showing us they're really sad.
Well, it's sort of universal human emotions that have nothing to do with circumstances.
Sure, exactly. Right. You can also do it with humor. I think Cheever does that very well. Cheever puts you on the side of these characters by making you laugh with them. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't get that from Stillman.
One film that I think is very interesting to think about as you look at how pop culture wrestles with this is Arthur.
Yeah.
Not only to look at the film, but look at the differences between the original film of Dudley Moore and the remake with Russell Brand. And if you've seen these two films, you know that the remake required much more literally and figuratively rehabilitation of the main character in order to get to the ending. The original Arthur, and you know, it's hard to remember this until you actually go back and watch it, but he's still just as drunk at the end of the movie as he is at the beginning of the movie. And in fact, the whole sort of declaration of love and getting together with the love interest all sort of happens through a haze of booze.
Right.
It was kind of remarkable when
much
I went back and looked
for,
at it.
Much as it does for people with, you know, in another circumstance.
Right, exactly. So the Russell Brand version of Arthur has to do quite a bit more penance for that sort of life of indulgence and overindulgence, whereas the Dudley Moore Arthur was much more able, I think, to skate. Mm. Sometime between those two films, there developed more of an expectation that you're going to deal with sort of super indulgence as undesirable, or at least something that requires a lot of proper, responsible handling.
A lot of that has to have to do with the passing of time. I think a little bit of it might have to do with who we knew Dudley Moore to be at the time and who we know Russell Brand to have been.
Right. Russell Brand as a continuing boozer would not be that funny.
Right. I don't think you can come at that character quite the same way with that actor. I want to talk a little bit. I want to switch to something that's quite contemporary right now. There's been a lot of conversation about how in our perilous economic times, the characters on a show like Revenge cannot really be allowed to be happy in their wealth.
Right.
Well, that's an interesting point in general. I think that, at least in fictional portrayals of the wealthy, their success has to be undercut. Whether it's Wes Anderson and that just oozing melancholy, or broader comedy in which the rich guy gets pushed into the pool at the end, you know, Hollywood always seems to want to sort of teach us that lesson, that the rich can't really be happy.
Right.
And as true as it is that is absolutely a trope in fiction, it is also the story behind an entire genre of unscripted television that is now incredibly popular.
Right. Yes.
All of your Real Housewives shows, your kind of wealthy people buying real estate shows, your wealthy people bossing their assistants around. Mm-hmm. There's a tremendous amount of television that's now made in which both you kind of get the part where it's partly like, look at this pretty
decadent.
Look at this pretty, you know, for example, look at them throwing this party. Look how fancy it is. Look how beautiful it is. Look how indulgent it is. Isn't that cool? But then, of course, they're gigantic jackasses. So you sort of get that same balance between, you know, sure, they have this beautiful, wealthy life, but of course, they can't really
flipping tables. And,
right. Exactly. And they can't really be happy.
I'm going to posit that there are a few exceptions to this. One is Richie Rich. Mm-hmm. Just because.
Sure.
Silver Spoons.
Maybe a little bit, sure.
Riding the train around the living room.
Two is a whole swath of comedies from the 20s through the 40s.
Yeah, I was about to mention that. Mm-hmm.
Where you get people like Nick and Nora Charles, who are not just wealthy, but booze hounds.
Absolutely.
And having a great time.
Yeah.
And they're the heroes.
Yeah.
And they win in the end.
Two films deal with this. First is Sullivan's Travels, which is about a filmmaker who goes across the country because he's disillusioned with the films he's been making because they don't really connect with the people. And he finds out that people in the middle of the Depression desperately want to see happy, smiley, rich people
escapism.
Boozing it up.
Right.
And the other thing that played into that also was Purple Rose of Cairo, where the Mia Farrow character goes just to get out of her horrible, miserable life just to see these people on the screen. So
yeah, it has always been possible to present a wealthy decadent. I think especially as Trey pointed out in earlier eras, mm-hmm. it's always been possible for that person to be sympathetic. The Lady Eve, she's a sort of rich girl and she's not going to, you know, give away all her money and she's still not a terrible person. And there is that aspirational quality, you know, but it also can kind of be played with a little bit.
The third example I wanted to bring up was European set costume dramas.
Right.
And there's something, there is a difference between the European set costume drama of Pride and Prejudice, those kinds of books.
And Downton Abbey.
Right. And Downton Abbey. Although there's a certain amount of angst in both of those.
There is.
But it's not Henry James.
Right.
Right.
There is a really different and really complicated relationship between Americans and their wealth.
Right.
And Europeans.
That's
and
so
wealth.
True. Mm-hmm. That is so true. Because you also have all of the, you know, this Dickens stuff mm-hmm. with, you know, Scrooge, and which I think there's sort of a straight line from that to the It's a Wonderful Life, Mr. Potter
right.
vision of sort of mean old rich dude. You know, and the only way for the people to fight back is for everyone to get together and mm-hmm. you know, fight back against a rich guy because he has all our money. And, you know, I think you're right that there's kind of this tendency to have this very Scroogey mm-hmm. kind of. I'm kind of shocked that Stephen hasn't already mentioned Scrooge McDuck.
Well, and absolutely. Scrooge McDuck is a good one. I was too busy racing through another Undercover Boss screed and ultimately deciding not to. But, you know, you do have this phenomenon, getting back to unscripted television briefly, of the rich person as benevolent daddy,
right.
which is, you know, not only Undercover right. Boss, which I've screamed about on this show before, mm-hmm. but your short-lived Benefactor mm-hmm. with Mark Cuban, mm-hmm. Donald Trump, yeah. right. you know, on The Apprentice.
A bit of Shark Tank. Although,
yeah. Classmates.com is a great company.
Although I would say The Apprentice, I think the Trump stuff also has that element of dance monkey dance kind of thing.
But at the same time, there's, you know, he's John D. Rockefeller throwing money from the blimp.
Right. Yep. At the same time that people who are very, very wealthy are often being held up in these shows as somewhat ridiculous, there's also something that is supposed to be sort of like, here's someone who made a lot of money. They love to have things about people who made a lot of money in real estate, people who made a lot of money flipping houses, mm-hmm. Things that aren't necessarily what people have. Things that aren't necessarily what people have in mind when they think about traditional ideas of making money through mm-hmm. hard work and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of idolizing people who come by their money in sort of whatever way.
It's funny you mention that. A couple of weeks ago, I talked about the Bayou billionaires
sure. mm-hmm.
people. And that's a sort of exception because those people seem happy, as I think I mentioned yeah. then. They seem, you know, yeah. they're a little wackadoo, but yeah. they seem happy and they're a tight-knit clan. And the show is kind of about celebrating that.
Yeah. To me, another interesting show in terms of relationship with wealth generally is the white-hot show Storage Wars, which involves, if you've never seen it, people who go to storage auctions where essentially if you don't pay for your storage space, they will eventually auction off your stuff. The great thing about it is they open the door and so you can kind of see, but you can't go in and look around and you don't really know what's in it. You only know what you can see. You can't go inside. You can't move anything, touch anything. So people are kind of seeing like, oh, I see the edge of something that looks like it could be a bike. And they're trying to figure out what's in there. And it's really a gambling show. It's
right.
it's really
yeah, yeah,
a show that combines watching people gamble with a sort of an antiques roadshow
yeah.
where then they go and find out what all the stuff they got is worth. The reason I say it has this relationship with wealth is that there's a lot of focus on this idea of people casting off things of value that you then have the opportunity to kind of get rich by your own sort of,
you know,
your own cunning. That's exactly yeah. what it is. Your mm-hmm. own sort of ability to go in and, you know, but if you think about it, in some cases, these are just people who have decided it's not worth it to get a U-Haul and get their stuff out.
Yeah.
But in some cases, these are undoubtedly incredibly sad stories
right.
of either somebody who died and their family didn't know they had the storage space.
Right.
So it's somebody's, you know, incredibly
priceless,
valuable stuff
yeah.
that they would have passed on to their grandkids if anybody had known they had the storage space. Right? I mean, and yet you can kind of get away with it as this kind of like found treasure
right.
idea, yeah. which is sort of, you know, witness the recent Mega Millions thing
yeah.
is still kind of our right. favorite thing.
Well,
I can become treasure.
I can become massively wealthy without actually doing anything or making anything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, which you know, is certainly my dream.
And it right. and it feels like money that comes from nowhere when
right.
in fact
Even
it
though,
all comes from somewhere.
Right.
You know.
We can't get off this topic without mentioning Absolutely Fabulous as a show.
Oh my goodness,
which,
yes.
Which kind of lampoons. And the idea of we like watching the high and mighty brought low goes back to Greek drama. So right. And there's a reason
right.
why.
Right, right.
There's I assumed that Trey was going to be the one to bring
I figured I was waiting for Trey to bring it. Basically, every soap opera out there has always had the wealthy family.
Well, and obviously Dallas and Dynasty,
sure,
and,
exactly.
and that kind
Victor
of
Newman.
In the right Victor Newman in, in the you know in the and 80s the, in the
and the current half hour sitcom GCB. I think it's a half hour anyway.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, I like it. It's rich people in Dallas behaving quite badly, and I have come to enjoy this show. I have to confess, in the very same way that I enjoyed a pair of piping hot Krispy Kremes right off the production line this morning.
Yep.
I am watching the heck out of that show.
Not many people know, but absolutely fabulous. They made a documentary. They adapted it as a documentary, a show called Hey Paula. Do you guys remember Hey Paula?
I do.
Which was the Paula Abdul documentary series, the reality show.
I do remember that. I watched
Good
a little bit of that.
Good Lord. You watch it with the same, it's not Schadenfreude exactly.
No, it's you watch it through your webbed fingers.
Yeah.
Your
Which could always turn the channel if you're really nervous. But incidentally, I should mention, you know, this is not an exhaustive inventory
of
rich families. There are going to be people who say, why didn't you mention soap? I can't believe you didn't mention,
right.
you know, whatever.
Grey Gardens.
There are tons and tons and tons of rich families and rich couples. And, you know, feel free to, I think this is a really rich, like, kind of cool and interesting topic. And I would love to hear what people have to say about sort of the portrayals that work for you and don't work for you. And, you know, I think changes over time and different little trends in how these things are portrayed. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or at the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And you can find the show there, and we'll be holding a discussion in that space as well. So now that we have tackled tax time, we do have another topic today, which is made for me. Tax time, by the way, not made for me.
Mm-hmm.
We had a Facebook comment from somebody who said, you know, how about talk about the culture that is made just for you, that you feel like it was put there just to appeal to your particular collection of proclivities.
Personality disorders.
Yeah, exactly. Of proclivities. Glenn Weldon, why don't you kick us off?
There's a difficulty with this topic because that feeling that we're talking about is an electric feeling. As you mentioned earlier, it's this feeling that somewhere in some secret underground lab underneath Wyoming, something has been genetically engineered, sequenced to the receptors, to your hormone receptors, and that is an electric feeling. The thing about it is, when you feel that feeling of, I guess you'd call it exclusivity, maybe, the first thing you want to do with it is share it with other people.
Yeah.
That's the weird thing about this.
You
feel like, I must then, because if you get that excited about something, you just feel like you need to share it. And of course, that is a recipe for disaster, because if it really is your thing, it's not going to appeal. Although, the classic example of this, I've already talked about on the show. I've talked about many of these things that made me feel about this away on the show, as I think we all have. But the Guy Madden film, Careful, is just an odd, for my money, the funniest film ever made and ever will be made. It's great. But it is odd, and it is determinedly odd. And so every time I would try to show that film to somebody else, it would not go over well. Because for whatever reason, it was pitched for me. Now, there are other people out there who love the film as much as I do, but yeah, it's a weird little gem. The David Foster Wallace essay, A Supposedly Fun Thing I'll Never Do Again, which is about his experience on a cruise. Now, I love it. A lot of people love it, but there was something about that. And when I'm looking over this list here of the things that inspire this in me, the stories of Alice Munro, every time I start a new story, I'm like, oh, really, Alice? We're going to write about 19th century Canadian pioneer woman again? Really? And then by the end of it, I'm like, this is the best story ever. Mm-hmm. There's a short story by Donald Bartlemy called The School, which is a perfect piece of fiction. It is hilarious. It is funny. Mm-hmm. The writing of George Saunders, Stephen Milhauser. What these guys have in common is that the sense of humor in it appeals to me. I recognize, I see myself in the sensibility of it.
Let me take you back to the David Foster Wallace.
Yeah.
Given the great popularity of that piece, you know, not only does everybody love it, but everybody who's ever been on a cruise sort of says, well, it's exactly what it's like and all that stuff. What do you think it is for you particularly? Because I hesitate to sort of say, is it the misanthropy? But
This is how I think about it. He uses footnotes relatively liberally.
Right.
There is one footnote. When you go down to the bottom of the page, you see a single exclamation point. Because all he's doing is he's wanting you to see, oh, geez.
Yeah.
And that was the moment I fell in love with this piece.
Yeah.
Because it's using a technique that we all know in a way that really opens it up in a way.
I do know other people other than you who love punctuation humor, though.
Yeah.
Finger was pointed in this direction.
Yeah.
Particularly brackets.
I got a couple others, but I've talked a lot, so let's go.
Trey Graham.
Well, we are not far from our first segment and the topic of rich people having really, really bad times.
Mm-hmm.
We have discussed on various episodes the things that push my buttons, right? So let me give you three bullet points. a deeply messed up, gloomy gothic story of passion and repression and obsession and self-denial.
Yeah, we got that.
Set on the palatial estate of a baroness somewhere in northern Europe. So there are corsets and also country dances.
Oh, you're just pandering to our audience.
I really kind of am. It's written by two men.
I think you've explained this before. We always come back to Trey and the
corsets.
Trey and the women with the dresses you can hide under.
I am closing in on another specific example of this kind of thing.
Rock on, Trey Graham.
Written, this particular example is by two men with a penchant for wild musical romanticism. And who either were or were not romantically involved, depending on whom you ask. They were. I'm talking, of course, about Vanessa, the opera from 1958.
I'm talking, of course, about the 1958 opera Vanessa. Yes.
Come now, I gave you the Baroness and the Northern Europe.
Familiar to anyone who knows anything about German.
There you go.
American mid-century opera, not German. Samuel Barber opera, commissioned by the Met. Let me outline for you just how bizarre this story is. The title character, 20 years ago, had an affair with a married man. Since then, she has locked herself up in her palatial estate, with the lights low and the windows covered and the mirrors all draped in fabric, waiting for him to come back to her. 20 years.
This is right up your alley.
20 years. In the opening scene, she has gotten word that he is coming back, and so she's neurotically, like, planning the dinner menu. When he shows up, arriving just before dinner time, emerging from an arduous trek through the forests and through a terrible blizzard, does she welcome him warmly? Does she embrace him? No. What she does is she turns her back to him, and she sings to him one of the opera's first great arias, which is called Do Not Utter a Word. And she literally sings to him, Do not utter a word, Anatole, do not move. And so what she says to him in this aria is, I have waited on your slow ass for 20 years, preserving my beauty and refusing by an act of will, basically, to age. And here is what I need to hear from you right now. You need to tell me that you still love me, or you don't even get to look at me, and I will put you out of my house and you can head back out into the store.
I don't feel heard, honey.
Right?
Exactly. No, don't speak.
And
don't
that
speak.
Is... right. That is...
Say nothing.
Diane Wiest. That is just the beginning of the cray-cray in this opera. There is a bait and switch and a fortune hunter and a niece who gets seduced and a self-induced miscarriage. And Vanessa's mother, the old baroness, who refuses to so much as speak to anyone who acts
this
the fool.
This was written for you.
Oh, seriously.
It was intended originally for Maria Callas, who took one look at the libretto and the score and said, I might be getting the title character here and I might get the last curtain call, but the second lead is the one who's going to get the big ovation. And she said, no thanks. She turned it down. And she turned out to be absolutely right. The role of Vanessa ended up going to Eleanor Stieber, who is one of the great mid-century American sopranos, just homegrown, rock-solid, amazing soprano. And the second lead is Erica, the niece, who is the tragic figure. Vanessa is so desperate to reconnect to this man that she once loved. That she's
a
willing
mistake,
to.
Ladies.
She's, I know, right?
That's a deal breaker, ladies.
So she's so she convinces herself that the man who has arrived at the house, who is the original lover's son,
is actually him.
Is actually him, yeah. Or at least she's willing to make
right.
the deal.
Sure.
And she goes off and gets married, and Erica turns herself into Vanessa and dresses in black and drapes the mirrors and shuts up the house. It's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is a highly problematic look at female agency in relationship to male privilege, but. Oh my God, when it is firing on all cylinders, it is the most beautiful music, and it is so good. Please check it out.
Wonderful.
Okay, well,
it's
Vanessa.
Wonderful. God, it's
I'm wondering if it's going to hold up that the thing that is made especially for Trey is made also especially not for Glenn. And I'm wondering if the thing that's made for Steven is going to be especially not for Glenn.
Mm-mm.
It's like negative space.
I can see thing that's made for Steven, and you're going to like it.
Go ahead, Steven.
Pass. No, I'm just kidding.
Football.
Diet Coke. I mean, there were several directions I could go with this. I did not just want to talk about things that I always talk about on this show.
Right.
This is Spinal Tap. Anything that mixes sort of sadness with wry sarcasm. Is it just happens to be like right in the old your magnetic field 69 love songs
sure.
your anything that your Clem Snide touches. You know, you mentioned litmus tests, Glenn,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I always think of you know, certain among these things, like particularly that Clem Snide album Your Favorite Music, as the litmus test record. Not where I won't like you if you don't like it, but you would probably not like me if you don't like it. In that sadness and wry sarcasm vein, the comic books of Daniel Clowes Klaus.
Sure.
Which, was that you, Linda, who left a gigantic treasury of Daniel Klaus comics on my desk, mm-hmm. making me the happiest, saddest little boy in the entire NPR office? You know, musically, particularly when you get your favorite musicians covering unrelated favorite songs, Bon Iver covering Bonnie Raitt's I Can't Make You Love Me, which is a song that always makes me cry, and then when you have Bon Iver covering it, it sort of is compounded. Speaking of Clem Stein and Yves Barsley, he did an album recently of cover songs that people paid him to perform, and one of them was of Neutral Milk Hotel's In the Aeroplane Over the Sea, which is one of my favorite songs, and you have that performed by one of my favorite artists. But what I thought I would throw out there is Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog,
sure.
which manages to combine... Like, you know, remember that when we were talking about the Jason Bateman insemination comedy?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And Linda was explaining it to Glenn, and it was like, first this happens, and Glenn's like, I'm out. And then this, I'm out.
I'm out.
You know, and it's just thing after thing. So Dr. Horrible sing-along blog, Neil Patrick Harris, I'm in. Joss Whedon, I'm in. Nathan Fillion, I'm in. Mm-hmm. You know, just right down the line of, you know, even though it is technically a musical, and I am usually agnostic where musicals are concerned, it's a perfect...
Well, it's short.
It's also short. You're right. Little time commitment. Mm-hmm. That was one that my mother sat me down and made me watch, as if I needed to be coaxed.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of interesting to sort of fan out briefly into a larger topic here. We're heading more and more into this kind of Kickstarter world, where if you find a decent-sized pockets of people who are just like me, you can make these pieces of art, these sort of, I can't believe this movie that speaks to me so directly somehow managed to get made, it won't make any money at all.
Right.
That you can fund these things by finding, you know, 1,000 Glenn Weldons ponying up $25. Mm-hmm. You know, speaking again of Yves Barsley, he's putting out a record of songs that he wrote for people where they commissioned him to write these songs.
Right, right.
We've talked about that project, too. He is now kickstartering an album called Songs for Mary, which is all of these kind of things. And I think you're going to be able to finance more things like Dr. Horrible Sing-Along Blog, you know, in the future, where, I mean, Joss Whedon, of course, has, like, 1 million, 2 million, 3 million of those people and can easily get a project like that made.
Right.
The more esoteric you get, you're still going to be able to find sort of these pockets of obsessives who are like, that sounds like the thing that will speak to me better than anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. Good choices. Well, I think the problem that we have all somewhat struggled with this topic is that we have done a whole bunch of different variations over the life of the show on things I love, which is great because we love talking about things we love. But you always want to try to find like a new thing that you love. So what I tried to do was think about this question in a couple of specific ways, one of which is one way this comes into play for me is anytime you're talking about what's basically a genre or a formula where there's a general outline of things that a lot of them have in common, what are the ones that stick out to you particularly? And with me, my genre of choice when I talk about this kind of thing tends to be romance novels, so I'll go in that direction. I tend to go contemporary. I don't really read historical novels. I don't really read Regency and, you know, The Big Skirts and all that stuff. Sorry, Trey. So I tend to go contemporary. And there is a writer whose name is Julie James who just put another book out, which I breezed through over the weekend and, you know, devoured as I do. Her books are A, romantic, B, funny. They have banter. C, they're about lawyers. So you can always get me with a good, kicky, bantery romance about lawyers. I like that. So that's an example for me is when, you know, things will specifically strike you from within a genre. Another example is things where because it's made specifically for you, you love it in a way that later you sort of feel like you can't really justify, but it still worked on you. My example here, I don't care what you people say, is Jerry Maguire. Now, you have your love story, which contains many elements that I'm very fond of. You have your awkward sex scene. I love an awkward sex scene. You have your adorable Moppet, who is not only adorable but also slightly weird, which I like. I like a weird kid. Sports banter. I like sports banter. Lovable underdog, like, you know, guy against the, you know, especially doing it through writing something that's ill-advised because... It's very easy for me to relate, imagine myself doing that. So, you know, that's an example of one where there's a lot of music in it that I like. It struck so many chords in me that I think it became something that I loved a lot more than I would really be able to justify to anyone else. So as Glenn was saying, there's that tension between, I love it. I'm not saying you're going to.
Right.
Right.
I'm not saying it would mean as much to anyone else as it does to me.
Has any film in history launched as many catchphrases as that film? Show me the money. Help me help you. You had me at hello.
Incidentally, the you had me at hello scene, I'm just going to tell you right now, is the worst scene in that movie.
Oh, yeah.
The worst, most unnecessary.
You
because the thing they do right before that, where they kind of break up just because it's such a bad situation, is the best part of the movie in a lot of ways.
One of the best things about that movie also is not only does that have an awkward sex scene, but man, that movie has a really awkward wedding.
It's a,
The wedding.
The wedding scene is agonizing.
I feel about You Had Me at Hello like I feel about Andy McDowell and Is It Raining?
Yeah. I hadn't noticed. Yeah, it's so bad. Anyway, so those are the things that are made for us. And feel free, obviously, come and find us on Facebook or at the blog and tell us what's made for you. We would love to hear it. And that brings us to our last segment. What is making us happy this week? Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
I'm not one given to hyperbole. So when I say that RuPaul's Drag Race is the pinnacle of human achievement, you know that I mean it, that future civilizations will look back on us and they will see this record and they will say, you know what? They knew what they were doing. Mm-hmm. Aliens, when they come to destroy the Earth for a hyperspace bypass, they will say, we will show them this and we will stay their hand. Last week, as we're taping this on an episode called Dads, I'd Like to Frock. Never mind. Yep. It came down to a drag queen by the name of Latrice Royale and a drag queen by the name of Kenya Michaels. Latrice Royale, big gal, pushing 40 if she hasn't pushed past it. Kenya Michaels, tiny, pretty, spirited, a Latin firebrand, something of a popinjay. They had to lip sync for their life. The song, because the show was awesome, was, of course, You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman. Sure. And as soon as the music starts, Kenya Michaels starts with the high kicks and the spins and the twirls, and she whips her wig off and she's doing all kinds of stuff. However, Latrice Royale plants her feet, her size 28 boots, in the middle of the runway and proceeds to interpret the song, to not sing because she's lip syncing, but to actually internalize the song in a way, because she knows that the song has a journey in it. You go from looking out at the morning rain, mm-hmm. not feeling uninspired, to joy. Kenya Michaels is just dancing. Mm-hmm. She's just going nuts. Mm-hmm. And it is a masterclass, not just in drag, but in art. Mm-hmm. Do you, when you interpret something, are you taking it inside you and filtering it through yourself? Or are you just filigreeing? Are you just dancing around the outside of it? Are you an artist or are you a decorator? Is kind of this dichotomy.
Is that a trick question?
Are you an artist or are you a performer? This was
the pinnacle of human achievement.
The pinnacle of human achievement. This has so much to teach us. So much.
And in soft focus, too.
Yes, in very soft focus.
That is a wonderful choice.
Yeah. Yes.
Making Glenn Weldon happy. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this
week?
Well,
the thing that I came prepared to discuss is something I have Glenn Weldon to thank for. And it is called The Chorus Boy Chronicles, which is a series of columns at McSweeney's Internet Tendency. They are dispatches from the life of a Maryland boy, a suburban Maryland boy from around here, who has made it, but just barely, to Broadway. He is what's called a swing in the Broadway production of Chicago, meaning he's the guy who sort of sits in the dressing room waiting to see if anybody's going to be out sick or gets injured during the show. Mm-hmm. So he has to know all of the parts, basically. He has to know all the male chorus ensemble parts, mm-hmm. and even some of the smaller featured roles. Mm-hmm. Which means he gets a lot of extra pay, just so you know. He's written 9 columns so far, starting last October, and he tells me it's supposed to run for a year. And what I like about it is, one, there's a really strong sense of place in his writing. There's one column where he's talking about a particular apartment that he used to share with a friend until it got completely overrun by mice, and I felt like I could see the apartment and hear the mice. And it was just a really good storytelling. But there's also an emotional rawness to some of these columns. He screws up. He sees his mistakes in retrospect. He's uncertain about his career path. And in fact, one of the things that's most interesting to me is the very clear sense that you get from him that he sees this part of his life as coming to a close. Mm-hmm. He's in his late 20s, and he's not sure that he's got the stomach for another Broadway audition, and he's looking to figure out what's next. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like reading somebody's diary, mm-hmm. Which it explicitly is. But he's approaching this existential threshold in his life, and so it seems oddly urgent.
Anyway, excellent.
The Chorus Boy Chronicles, it's called, at McSweeney's.
Lovely. Stephen Thompson.
Well, I have finished another book.
Jeez. Hush now.
I know.
The world is out of joint.
Yeah, we're going to have to get rid of that shtick. You can't have that shtick anymore.
I know. I'm going to have to actually just be a literate person who talks about books occasionally. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, obviously it is. I completed Mockingjay. I finished that particular trilogy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, now I'm sort of waiting for more Suzanne Collins books so that I'll have things to read. I do have her YA books that she wrote before The Hunger Games, and perhaps I'll turn there next. Entertain myself during Mockingjay by trying to figure out how they are going to make the movie for less than $700 million mm-hmm. and how they're going to make it PG-13.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Because seriously, there's just no way. Also, just been plowing through a string of really good records. Up on the NPR site right now, we have the new Spiritualized record. We have this new Horse Feathers record, which is the most Thompsonian, the string-swept folk rock ever. But also, because these things come in, you know, a couple months in advance, I'm already soaking up records that are coming out by people like Edward Sharpe and the Magnetic Zeros, Glenn Hansard, Sigur Rós, it's a really rich time of year. There's just a flood of good music.
Wonderful. Well, there are some weeks when it is difficult for me to come up with what's making me happy this week. This is not one of those weeks. I got a letter this morning from a fan of the show. Her name is Morgan. And without giving out too many identifying details, she is 8, and she lives overseas. She's in a military family. And for a school project at her school, they asked the kids to think of someone they would consider a role model or mentor.
Oh, wow.
So Morgan wrote me this letter, which says, I'm in third grade. I have brown hair and green eyes. I'm in gifted education. I'm verbal linguistic. I am also in chorus. Were you in chorus in high school? I write a lot, so I want to be a pop culture artist, too. Goes on to say that she uploaded our radio station.
Okay.
And says, I loved your radio station, especially your theme song.
Oh, catsip.
I love music and writing, also reading. Did you do all these things in third grade? And then she actually sent me a little bit of her sort of poetry, labeled at the bottom, original lyric. It's pretty much the best thing that's ever happened to me. I think people sometimes don't realize that expressing your appreciation to people whose work you like, being on the receiving end of that continues to be a very profound experience at times. And this was a very profound experience, partly because this was very much like getting a letter from Linda Holmes, age 8.
Yep.
And I'm just going to, you won't be able to see it on the podcast, and I can't really put it up, but I'm going to show to Stephen and Glenn, Trey already saw it, her picture. This is basically a letter from myself.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And, you know, people who listen to the podcast know I'm a career changer. I've taken a few different directions. You're often uncertain about your direction in life, I think. Mm-hmm. There are many worse things that can happen to you than a letter from essentially yourself, mm-hmm. age 8, saying, I think you're doing awesome. You know, obviously, I will write to her and we'll chat more. If she's hearing this, thank you so much. This is incredibly lovely. And we'll chat more. But I was in chorus. I did love music and reading and writing, and I did do these things in third grade, and you're doing everything right, and I'm sure you're going to do, awesome. So that, naturally, is what's making me happy this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, Mike KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music. Morgan really likes it, right? And you should too. Thanks to all of you guys for being here as always.
Thank you. Yeah.
And thanks to all of you for listening, especially if you're 8 years old. And we will see you back here next week.